Welcome to Security Squad, a CertSecurity.com podcast for June 2011. In this edition, we'll talk about the impact of LulzSec, or lack of impact, depending on who you talk to. The hacktivist group has disbanded, but not after it successfully penetrated some websites and released some sensitive data. Also, rogue antivirus hit Mac users hard. It was a big enough problem that Apple had to respond. We'll talk about that. The payment card industry data security standards are back in the news. This time, the PCI Council issued guidance on securing credit card data on virtualized systems. Does the guidance help? We'll see. And finally, World IPv6 Day came and went. It got a lot of visibility in the media, but are enterprises taking a wait-and-see attitude? We'll find out. Joining me in the studio is Eric Parizeau. Eric is senior site editor of CertSecurity.com and the Security and Media Group. Eric, hey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
Now, you returned from the Gartner Security and Risk Management Summit in Washington, D.C. Recently, haven't you?
I did. I wrote a column last week about my top five takeaways from the show. You can get that at CertSecurity.com/news, but I'm sure we'll touch on some of those themes here today as well.
Awesome. And Mike Mimoso is also here. He's editorial director of the Security Media Group. He's the chief squad leader. Mike.
I didn't know that.
Well, Mike, you and I will be headed down to Las Vegas in about a month's time. Any expectations for this year's show?
No, but I've packed already.
Yeah, we'll see if they have ATM machines spitting out cash. Again this year. Was yes. that last year?
That was last year. Yeah. Was last year. Couldn't get in there to see it. I had to watch from the hallway.
So let's go right into some of the latest news. Impact of LulzSec, this hacktivist group, which is now, they announced they're now disbanded. In the span of about 50 days, the group made plenty of headlines. First, they started off posting the names and addresses and phone numbers of thousands of contestants on The X Factor on Fox, the Fox TV program. They posted transaction logs for ATM machines in the UK. Supposedly, they had been involved in some of the Sony breaches. It's unclear whether the group was responsible in the initial breach.
And my personal favorite was the hack on the PBS website, which, of course, led to the fake news story that Tupac was alive and well in New Zealand, which I was sad turned out to be untrue, but still impressive nonetheless.
Where else would he be?
that's
naturally.
They launched denial of service attacks against the CIA. And maybe the most serious thing that they had done was this attack on the Arizona Department of Public Safety. Have you guys heard about this? The personal information of 8 officers, including their home addresses and the names of their spouses, was publicly posted with. And this all happened in the span of about 50 days. Did this group really have an impact on IT security, though? Mike, do you want to start that off?
You know, all of a sudden we're back to 2000, 2001 when I started covering security where these guys are, you know, it's all about hacking for notoriety. I mean, what's all the vendor marketing going to do now? Every briefing that comes in here, it's like, you know, it's all about profit. And now they're back to activism. And that's basically what this is. And they, you know, they've got their 15 minutes of fame in the traditional media, the Wall Street Journal's covering this and the Times and CNN and you know, they're getting their 15 minutes of fame, and that looks like LulzSec is pulling out of the game for now, and some of these guys are going to join Anonymous or, you know, whatever you believe that they're posting online. But, you know, as far as an impact on IT security, it's just another threat that everybody has to watch out for, and it doesn't change, I don't think, strategically or tactically what you're doing. I mean, you know, you still have to protect your data, and if you got anything of value that somebody might want or you might be embarrassed if you lose, you know, you've got to protect it.
And that was actually my question to you, Eric. It was, you know, whether certain organizations should respond either tactically or strategically to these kinds of attacks.
Well, let me go on a little bit of a jag here because my argument is I think these guys are a gift wrapped present to IT security, and let me tell you why. I think when we look back on 2011 and we ask, all right, what was this year all about? And I think we're going to recognize this year for what's essentially been a hacking renaissance. We've seen it in everything from the RSA Secure ID attack to these attacks to you know the breach that brought down Sony's network for a month. There have been some impressive high profile hacks that have been conducted, and you know, clearly it's the work of talented yet malicious people. But I think that at a certain point, and this is where LulzSec, I think, came to be, a lot of the individuals who are sort of behind these attacks on an anonymous level, not necessarily an anonymous group, but you know, anonymously conducting these attacks, I think got tired of that and said, you know, I want my 15 minutes of fame. And I think that's what's led to some more of this quote-unquote hacktivism, not necessarily about disrupting government as much as it is, you know, getting in the spotlight for certain individuals. That said, I think enterprises should be, you know, counting their blessings that they have all this new ammo to take to their CIOs and say, you know, look at all these new malicious hacks that are taking place. Now, you know, ultimately some of these are fairly small or lower profile, but it's just more bullet points to put on your PowerPoint presentation to say, all right, here's some more of the worst case scenarios that we are not prepared to defend against today, and why we need new budget, new investment, new tools, new products to try to defend against some of these attacks.
Eric, you're not supposed to sell security based on FUD, not even internally. Well, seriously, though, I got to take issue with something you said, though. I don't think we're seeing a renaissance of hacking. I don't think that even the RSA hack wasn't anything overly sophisticated. I mean, it's a phishing attack that worked in that case. These guys aren't doing anything overly sophisticated. They're taking advantage of shoddy security and, you know, some gaps and vulnerabilities that have been in place probably for a long, long time.
I would counter that by saying I think in the actual renaissance, I don't think they invented new ways to paint. I think they put the paint on the canvas in a very interesting and fascinating way to achieve works of art that were ultimately some of the most, you know, interesting. And
you guys
and
think the economy is playing into this somewhat? These are you know, young people, at least it's alleged to be mostly young people involved in this group. The UK hacker Ryan Cleary was 19 years old. It's still unclear whether he was actually a member of this group, because after he was arrested, somebody else was using the Twitter account to post messages. So who knows?
He may have
been a member. He may not have. But I ask whether this is the economy plays into this, because why don't these guys have jobs? You know, maybe they're bored. They're sitting in their basement.
They
can't
money.
Get jobs.
Well, see, that's exactly the point I'm making, is that I think these, like the LulzSec people, I think they have jobs. I think they work for underground criminal networks, you know, as contractors to the highest bidder.
Why would they do that if this is only going to fuel the flames to get more security technologies in place? And,
well, they don't think of it that way. They do their work. They get their money, and then they realize, hey, I want to be a star too, and that's where LulzSec
is. It's all about fame and glory.
See, I think there's a bit of truth to that too. I think it's about notoriety. It's about a bit of one-upsmanship. Who knows what circles
but
these guys
anonymous.
Run in.
They were anonymous. How do you
okay,
throw
but,
the notoriety
all right,
in there if
I,
you're anonymous?
Then they're part of something bigger and they want to break off and be their own thing.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean,
there's different levels of anonymity, though. Let's remember that in the kind of underground hacking community, a lot of these people go by hacker handles. So you have a certain reputation that you want to advance there, even if it's not attached to your, you know, given name, your legal name. You want your reputation in that community to be advanced, and I think that's also what a lot of it's about. And I think what happened was the LulzSec attacks got to the point where, you know, they were so big and so prominent and brought so much legal heat on them that it became more than they wanted, and hence they tried to suddenly get out of the spot.
I mean, look at the legitimate hacking community, all right? You've got a guy like Mark Dowd. Nobody really knows Mark Dowd except unless you're in the inner circle of hackers. This guy is supposed to be brilliant. He's supposed to be, you know, the best of the best. Everybody wants to be marked out. Dan Kaminsky has his own level of notoriety. Some people want to be Dan Kaminsky, some people don't. That's in the legitimate community. Can you imagine what it's like in the underground, whatever that might be? You know, these guys play on forums. They talk to each other however they talk to each other. I want to be better than Eric. Eric wants to be better than Rob. And you know, maybe it's maybe they just decided to take it a little bit more public. Now, I don't know, we're speculating. Who knows?
And I would say ultimately, and their hope is that it would lead to more money. If they are known for some high profile hacks, even if they don't make money, you know, for the next, you know, big RSA type exploit that someone wants to hire them to conduct, they're going to say, oh, I got to go get this guy because I know he can do it.
And they pay.
Exactly.
Tax-free. Cash.
Uncle Sam does not get a chunk.
Yeah.
Did these hackers deserve the attention that they got?
It's a sexy story for CNN. Did we cover it, you know, the way they did?
Here and there.
Here
definitely
and there.
Definitely not.
Right. Different audience, different motivations. I don't, personally, no, I don't think so, but.
Hard question to answer. I mean, the media is driven by what people ultimately want to consume, so. You know, like you said, it's an interesting story. They conducted a lot of high profile hacks.
Yeah. Well, not necessarily hacks either. Some of this stuff was just
Exactly. But I mean,
DDoS.
I think when you know you're posting cops' names, addresses, their families online, then that's a different issue. And you know, exposing that and you know stopping it from happening again, yeah, then definitely it deserves some attention. But you know, to put these guys on some kind of pedestal and make it sound like there's something devious going on. Yeah, probably,
one
not,
of the things,
probably not so much.
All right, let's move on to Mac Defender. This is a rogue antivirus program, really surfaced when Apple support started getting hundreds and then thousands of phone calls from Mac users complaining that they had what they thought was security software on their machine, and it kept on alerting them to issues, and even when they gave up their credit card information to try to get rid of this, these alerts, and supposedly rid themselves of these, of the malware that this fake antivirus program detected. They kept getting alerts. It was big enough that Apple actually responded. Eric, let's start with you, just in terms of whether you think this is just something that is expected given Apple's success.
Oh, sure, no question. You know, I had a conversation with Neil McDonald at the Gartner Security and Risk Management Summit last week, and that video is on searchsecurity.com/news for anyone who wants to check it out. But he and I largely agree, I think, in that there's been a misconception for a long time that Apple is much more secure than Windows, and by itself is fairly secure. Not the case. Apple has plenty of software flaws as well, and now that we're starting to see increased Mac adoption in general, you know, as well as, you know, limited use in the enterprise still, but still, you know, not insignificant, there's increased attention on exploiting that platform. And I think the watershed event really was earlier this year when we started to see Mac crimeware kits come out. And that, I think, led to this rogue antivirus that we're seeing. Because it essentially lowered the bar, made it that much easier for, you know, Joe Smith hacker to exploit Mac flaws. So now that we're starting, and clearly we're starting to see more of these sorts of infections. So I think definitely it's, you know, Apple's a victim of its own success. But that being said, I think it may ultimately be a good thing in that it gets more organizations to pay more attention to the importance of Mac security.
And Windows is still obviously the target of choice for attackers. It's probably very likely that it's going to take a lot of time before the amount of malware catches up or the amount of attacks catch up to Windows machines.
Oh, sure. And it may never catch up. But I think the more important point is that attackers still recognize that it's much easier to attack the software stack in some form, be it via Windows or Mac or third-party applications. This is just another method of doing that, but because the Mac, you know, has never really gotten a lot of attention before recently in this way, I think there's still a lot of greenfield territory for attackers yet to explore, unfortunately, and we're starting to see Apple only now start to respond to that.
Mike, in terms of Apple's response to security over time, they've been a lot quieter than Microsoft.
Yeah, they've hired some interesting people internally to do security. The new CSO, his name is
Adam, David Rice.
David Rice, that's it.
From he was an NSA guy.
Yeah, and we know Wendell Snyder. She's involved in their security, and she was on the ground floor of building the Microsoft SDL. So they brought in some experience.
No big announcements there, though.
No.
Highlight that.
Yeah, and there's not a lot of transparency into what's going on there, and obviously for a lot of business reasons, that's probably true, but. There's some folks in here from Mandiant not too long ago, and we're talking about a lot of what's happening with threats and risks out there. And, obviously the conversation came to mobility and the iPhone and tablet computing. And I think you're starting to see the beginnings of this critical mass that, needs to take place before attackers kind of start paying attention to a new platform. And the tipping point that they seem to think too is, what happens when your phone and your tablet becomes kind of a payment token. And then does that push it over the top? And that's when you start to see a lot of malware. And maybe this is just some kind of, proof of concept, just see what they can do with a platform, how successful it is in spreading something. So who knows? This is probably the first steps.
Yeah, since you mentioned the payments via devices, whether it be the tablet or smartphones, near-field communications, I think, is going to be a big topic in the future in terms of its viability and its security. Apple does have a lot of complicated issues to deal with. I mean, its platform that has really taken off is its mobile business, mm-hmm. With the iPhone, and now sales of the iPad have taken.
And I think, and this is just, again, obviously my personal opinion, but I think the thinking inside Apple for a long time is that what fundamentally separates the Mac OS from Windows is that the Mac OS, it isn't run in quote unquote administrator mode. You don't have
it's Unix. Yeah.
You don't have those privileges.
Unix based.
Whereas in Windows, by default, very often users do have those privileges. Even in the enterprise setting, it's very common. So I think that has, it has helped them over time, but I think it's also contributed to perhaps a false sense of security for that platform, when in reality there are still, as I alluded to earlier, I think there are still plenty of ways to exploit it, that issue aside. So I think we're only going to see more of this sort of thing as time goes on.
And with that, we're going to move on to the payment card industry data security standards. The PCI Council came out with guidance associated with protecting credit card data on virtualized systems. And some of the feedback was that it was going to make securing virtualized systems much more difficult for organizations because of the fact that up until now, most enterprises have been relying on the acquiring the acquirers. Now they have to refer to this document, which ultimately some people believe QSAs are going to refer to when they assess systems. Do you think that this is really going to create shockwaves?
Maybe, but let me take it from a different angle. I think I largely disagree with your assertion, which is that my take is that I think it's going to make compliance easier if you want to use virtualization in your cardholder data environment. I think to really look at it from a high level, I think most assessors have tended to come down hard on virtualization up until this point because the guidance was fairly vague. So they took a conservative approach to it and in most cases frowned on nearly all types of virtualization in the CDE. Now I think these new guidelines shed a little more light on exactly what you should and shouldn't do in terms of not having untrusted systems on the same host or hypervisor as systems in the CDE, or making sure that your hypervisors are properly secured from one another, even if that means, you run security software or firewall, what have you, on individual hypervisors. So And to give her credit, Diana Kelly is influencing some of what I'm saying here. She's putting together some content that we're going to be featuring on searchsecurity.com shortly covering some of this. But the point is, I think now that this guidance is out there, it will give organizations more direct guidance on exactly how to make sure they can use virtualization securely in the CDE, and give assessors some guidance so they can help organizations use the technology as well and remain PCI compliant. So I think it's going to be a big win across the board.
There are some other implications, though, to it. I mean, what about the issue of cloud computing? I mean, it's funny, most of the report that came out referred to virtualization, and then there was this section towards the bottom that began talking about cloud computing and its impact when it comes to payment card data running on these hosted services. One of the statements in the report, quote, was that cloud computing presents a number of scoping challenges and considerations, and to a certain extent, it could be impossible to secure.
Well, let's not make the same mistake that I think a lot of people make about cloud computing, which is calling it, you know, cloud computing, it's one thing. There are a lot of different types of cloud computing. And separate from that, I think the biggest objective of this guidance was to offer insight into how to secure the use of virtualization internally in a cardholder data environment. I think if you're outsourcing your cardholder data environment to a cloud provider of some sort in terms of either, you know, platform, infrastructure, what have you, that's kind of a separate issue that I don't think this guidance was largely intended to cover.
They laid out specifically, and I'm looking at a document now, Marcia Savage of Search Cloud Security wrote a story that talked about how the document specifically said that distributed architectures add complexity. Public cloud environments are designed to be public-facing and internet-accessible. I think the most telling part was that the boundaries between tenant environments can be fluid. It's impossible to segment off anything involving payment data on a multi-tenant environment.
Yeah, you're right. They're basically saying it's too risky.
It's hostile.
To
they go as far as saying that it's hostile. they use the word hostile. It's a hostile environment.
It's hostile.
And they say these challenges may make it impossible for some cloud-based services to operate in a PCI DSS-compliant manner. And I'm sure that even though this document says it, this isn't the gospel, this is just a guidance document, it's going to ultimately come down to the acquiring bank, at the processor, and Visa and MasterCard, yeah, the issuers.
Yeah, I mean, for now, I don't think anybody's doing it. I mean, we run surveys. We did a survey during a couple of virtual events that we hosted here. And if I remember correctly, I think it was less than 15% of people saying that they would even consider putting credit card data and sensitive data in the cloud anyway.
Right.
So I don't think it's a huge issue. I think they would like some help, and I think they would like to do it. But at least from a security point of view, I don't think that, you know, they're willing to take that leap yet.
It all comes down to the individual implementation.
You know, if organizations are smart, they can look at this guidance and say, okay, here's a chance to get my server teams and my security teams to talk. I mean, security's not firing up virtual machines whenever they feel like it. It's some server administrator. It's some network guy. You know, I need another process. I need more storage. I need whatever. I'm going to fire up a virtual machine. Well, now there's some security guidance in place that says, hey, you need to do the X, Y, and Z. Before you do that, you need to consider this because we're running – you know, sensitive data through these virtual machines. Maybe there's some, you know, some dialogue that wasn't happening before that can start happening now. So it's an opportunity to promote security within. It's an opportunity to get a couple of people talking that maybe weren't talking before.
With that, we'll end this conversation and just say we'll be awaiting the tokenization guidance, which will be due out soon, and probably have another discussion about that and its relative impact on the payment industry. The final topic is IPv6. IPv6 day came and went. The whole issue around IPv6, and most people, I think, know this at this point, at least our listeners know that the address space on V4 is dwindling. And IPv6 is going to obviously expand that. But it is a completely different protocol, which requires a lot of retooling to enterprise networks, a lot of retooling to the organizations that support enterprise, the internet and the enterprise networks, network traffic. And that's why we had IPv6 day. There was some testing that was going on. And I had the opportunity to speak to Andy Champagne of Akamai. It was a participating organization in that day. Here's what he had to say.
From a usability perspective, it's not much more complex. What is much more complex is essentially the innards of it. There's more options. There are, frankly, more potential for things to go wrong compared to IPv4. When I say go wrong, you know, there's kind of two classes of security problems that I feel you could have with IPv6 from a host basis. One is based on configuration problems, meaning I didn't set up my IPv6 firewall, so I let everything through. Mm-hmm. The other is that the IPv6 stacks, the actual code within the kernels of the operating system, they're a lot less mature. V4 at this point has been, you know, used in production for quite a long time. IPv6 has existed for a long time, but hasn't seen the sort of traffic flows that IPv4 sees. So those code bases are not as well exercised, they're not as well understood, they're not as well understood at scale, and there's a whole class of security vulnerabilities that will probably pop up in that class of problems.
Eric, you wrote a column that got a lot of interest from our readers on IPv6. You had an opportunity to speak to some security experts in Virginia.
Yeah, at Virginia Tech, some students and staff there, they developed kind of an innovative IPv6 security tool that essentially seeks to secure the communications between two IPv6 hosts by developing a way almost to almost like a VPN to allow them to communicate securely back and forth. Yet predictably allowing them to change their addresses so that that communication can't be intercepted, but it isn't interrupted. Interesting stuff. Definitely check out the column if you haven't seen it. But to kind of circle around to, I think, where we started our podcast, we talked about how the low-hanging fruit today in terms of exploits is largely it's the application layer. Being able to exploit levels of the application stack is largely much easier for attackers than attacking the network layer these days because of IPv4 is a mature protocol. Firewalls and other network layer security technologies are mature. With IPv6, my fear is that that's going to reopen the floodgates for attacks on the network layer for a variety of reasons. I mean, just in summary, there's a false perception out there, first of all, that the IPv6 address, because it's so large, is hard to detect, but it's actually determined by a very repeatable pattern. So it's actually easier in some ways to determine a system's IP address on IPv6. There are other issues in play as well in terms of a lack of security testing tools for IPv6.
Hell yeah.
People, you know, security teams, network teams.
Is it Fernando Gosch?
Fernando Gonz, a contributor who wrote a series of great technical articles for us that are part of our brand new IPv6 security guide on searchsecurity.com. If you haven't had a chance to check it out, I definitely encourage you to do so.
This is a guy who actually tested some networks in the UK, some government networks in the UK for IPv6 issues.
Right. He's been involved with IPv6 for a long time, so he knows these issues intimately, but bottom line is there are a lot of issues from a security standpoint yet to be resolved with IPv6 that many organizations don't know about. So the fear is that they will seek to implement IPv6 internally, and you know many organizations have not done this yet because you know they aren't necessarily they don't necessarily need to today. It's more of an ISP issue in terms of the address space needs. But bottom line is that there are a lot of issues yet to be resolved. Organizations need to start looking at these issues today so that they can get the education they need, assess their infrastructure needs, and also put their vendors' feet to the fire to make sure that they are doing the proper testing and incorporating the right features to secure IPv6 when the enterprise transition happens.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because I had an opportunity to report on this, and it was a real learning experience for me. I spoke to a number of security vendors who were involved in World IPv6 Day, and I also spoke to Fernando in Brazil, who really helped kind of balance out some of the messaging from these security vendors. Depending on who you talk to, some people say you're going to need to replace your IPS and IDS. Some people say you're going to need to replace your firewall. Well, Fernando says that in many cases, it's going to just be a simple software update. However, it's going to really depend on the vendors and whether the vendors want to sell more product. They may not release a software update and require you to rip and replace some of your security tools. A lot of this hasn't been playing out yet because organizations are taking a wait-and-see attitude and are ultimately going to be forced into it, or they're going to be running V4 and V6 concurrently.
Yeah, I mean, this introduces a ton of complexity. I mean, we heard it from on a recent advisory board call.
That's right.
A lot of the folks on there that raised some of these issues, just basic security issues that were patched 10 years ago in IPv4 are resurfacing in 6 just because the protocol is so different and you know, the complexities that it introduces. You have to go back and find all these original problems. And like you said, it's just a simple software patch, but you know, these guys don't have time to patch what they're patching already, never mind a whole new network of traffic. And you know, the issue was raised too. A lot of security devices, a lot of security products just don't see this traffic yet. And you know, that has to be addressed. It's huge complexity.
It's also going to come down to a people issue. A lot of the early adopters, they have individuals within the organization who have taken a liking to it, who want to learn the new protocol and are trying to drive it within the organization. And those early adopters actually participated in World IPv6 Day because of that, because they had the leadership behind it. And I think that was echoed in the advisory call that you mentioned, Mike,
yeah,
that some of these guys said, it's going to be a learning experience here. It's a whole new protocol that we have to learn.
Right. I mean, they've gone into the Wayback Machine back to 1990, whatever, and they're starting over in some instances. And, you know, you're years away from a full transition.
It's
anyway,
kind of exciting.
If you like this networking plumbing stuff. Yeah.
It is kind of a cool thing from a networking perspective, because it certainly is going to really turn networking upside down over the next few years. But to your point, you know, again, there are a lot of different security issues that have yet to come into play. And the whole idea behind what we are doing here, talking about it, and what we've put together in our IPv6 security guide on searchsecurity.com, another plug, is to simply let people know about these issues so they can start the process of getting educated. Because as of today, there's still time. Most organizations, again, aren't dealing with this internally, but there will be a time when that transition is going to be necessary. And if organizations aren't prepared from a security standpoint, they're going to be left vulnerable and not even know it.
Well, that does it for this edition of Security Squad. Be sure to check out our previous podcasts by going to our podcast landing page at searchsecurity.com/podcast. And as always, you can get the latest security news and information at our news page at searchsecurity.com/news. For Mike Momoso, Eric Perizzo, I'm Rob Westervelt. Have a great day.